Hi, everybody. Welcome to another episode of Tides of History. As always, I'm your host, Patrick Wyman. Thank you very much for joining me. We've got a great guest here today. He's one of my very favorite writers of popular history, a genuine master of narrative. He's the author of numerous books, most recently Conquerors, How Portugal Forged the First Global Empire, and City of Fortune, How Venice Ruled the Seas, both of which I highly recommend to you all. Roger Crowley, thank you very much for joining me here today.
Thank you very much, Patrick. I'm delighted to be with you.
So your most recent book is Conquerors, which is on the early years of the Portuguese Empire and its expansion into the Indian Ocean. That's a fascinating topic. It's one I admit I didn't know a ton about before reading your book. Most of your previous books have been about the Mediterranean. So how did you decide on this topic?
It was almost accidental, although not quite. Towards the end of my previous book, which was about Venice, the Venetians learnt of an expedition to India, which they thought was Columbus. It was, of course, actually Vasco da Gama. And they were very worried. They suddenly thought that their whole business model of buying spices through Egypt was going to be outflanked. And I thought about this, and I thought this was actually a turning point in all sorts of ways. It was a turning point because the Mediterranean, which has been a kind of center of a great deal of historical activity, trade activity, is now going to slowly be turned into a backwater. And the world beyond that is going to become significant, the world of exploration. But actually, the impulse to write this book was more accidental than that. It was while I was caught in a vulnerable moment thinking what to write next, a Portuguese guy sends me an email saying, I like your books. You really ought to write a book about the Portuguese. Come and have a drink with me. So I went and had a drink with this man who was very interesting about Portuguese history, and I thought, yeah, that would be an interesting thing to do. It would take me out of my Mediterranean world.
Yeah, the passage that you're talking about, I remember this very clearly in your book on Venice, from the diarist Girolamo Priuli, right? Where he's talking about
that's
how
right.
This is he says something to the effect of this expedition is a greater threat to the city of Venice and its fortunes than all the wars of the Turks put together, or something along those lines. It's a really striking passage.
That's right, and from the other end of the spectrum, a Portuguese man said at about the same time, whoever is lord of Malacca, which was the hub of the spice trade connecting China with India, whoever is lord of Malacca has his hands on the throat of Venice. And it was said with a great deal of glee, the thought of undermining the Venetian monopoly. So they realized that this was a critical moment for them, although actually the effects on Venice were kind of slightly more slow burn than Priuli's dramatic idea of total collapse. But it was a moment of sudden realization.
That's very interesting. So we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about how the Portuguese built their global empire.
Okay.
So, and we're back. So, what do you think explains the speed with which the Portuguese went from exploring the coast of Africa to leaping all the way to India?
It's a very interesting question that. They had a long apprenticeship on the African coast, 60, 80 years of slowly working their way south. And during that period, they learned a lot of skills. They learned cartographic skills, sailing skills. They learned how to crack the puzzle of the Atlantic winds, which is kind of counterintuitive. You have to swing out into the Atlantic well away from land to be carried east around Africa. It was quite a frightening thing to do, and it took them a long time to learn that. At the same time, they became very good at information gathering. They learned how to gather information from people along the way, learning languages, collecting information and storing it for the next expedition. So it's kind of like an incremental process. When NASA wants to make a case for the long-term funding of exploration without a known outcome, they cite the case of the Portuguese, that they went this decade after decade, not quite as a kind of long-term global plan, but with a kind of intention to advance. When it came to the process of actually swinging round Africa to India, There's a bit of a mystery about this, actually. We don't know to what extent they made trial voyages before Vasco da Gama made his voyage. And it was a bit of a hit-and-miss thing. They very nearly came to a terrible end because they got the timing of the expedition wrong in the Indian Ocean. I think what was remarkable about this was not just getting to India, but how quickly they worked out how the 28 million square miles of the Indian Ocean worked. They didn't have Google Earth. They couldn't look down on it from space. But in about 10 years, they understood the pattern of the monsoons. They understood where the choke points were that you needed to control at the mouth of the Red Sea, at the mouth of the Persian Gulf, the Straits of Malacca, and so on. And so they all the skills that they'd learnt along the way on the African coast, they put to use very, very quickly. And they had a great system of feedback. Every expedition went out there, had to come back with its charts, which would be stored and which would be fed to the next expedition. So they really had a very good methodology of learning and learning for what they'd done. It was a kind of remarkable piece of scientific effort by the Portuguese in a very short time.
That's really fascinating, because in the way that you're presenting it here, it's less the work of any one individual or any group of individuals, so much as it is a kind of a collective project, a kind of a systemic approach to exploration and long-distance trade.
Absolutely. They had a sort of hub of knowledge storing called the CASA de India, the India House, where they collected this stuff. They also drew on a great deal of intellectual capital that was not Portuguese, map-making skills from across Europe, cannon-founding skills from the Germans, commercial skills from Italy. So they were drawing on a lot of intellectual capital to put this all together. But there was this, in the end, there turned out to be a plan to get to India, which crystallized over this 50-60-year period and became like a national project for them. So it was a remarkable and very modern approach to managing the process. And they were different from the Spanish in this respect. The Spanish were kind of like Pizarro and Cortes were kind of like privateers. The Portuguese, it was very much controlled by the king. It was a project that the Portuguese kings controlled themselves, and that the men that they sent out were very much under the thumb of the Portuguese king. It was a different model. It was kind of like a royal monopoly system, but it did mean that it was kind of a sort of central organization of the process.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And yeah, the contrast with the Spanish could not possibly be stronger, because Columbus is a freelancer himself. He's basically pitching his project wherever he can. The fact that he ends up being sponsored by the Castilian monarchs is more a function of the fact that that's where he manages to build a network of support, as opposed to some deep connection to Castile itself.
That's right. In fact, he tried very hard to persuade the Portuguese to take on his project. He learned all his sailing skills in Portugal, and the Castilians called him the Portuguese. The Portuguese actually turned him down because, among the other things, they had a committee of sort of astronomers and cosmographers, including quite a lot of Jewish intellectual capital, which they gained from Castile when they expelled the Jews. And these people turned him down because they said he'd made the world 25% too small in his estimation as to the distance to China. And so he didn't get any joy out of Portugal, and he had to go down the road to Castile. As you say, he was a freelancer touting his business proposal wherever he could, and the Castilians took him up. The Portuguese didn't.
Yeah, that was one of the things that was really fascinating to me, is that the Portuguese were not necessarily opposed to the kind of project that Columbus was proposing. They were opposed to Columbus.
Yes, they called him a falador, a boaster. They thought he overtalked himself, and he rather got up the noses of the Portuguese. Unfortunately, the fact that he sailed off to the Bahamas and Haiti and Cuba and so on, and came back claiming that he'd got to the outskirts of Japan, left the Portuguese king rather crestfallen that somehow they'd missed out on something. And it took quite a long time to work out that he hadn't, of course, got there. But He did rather rub it in by turning up in Lisbon on the way home, and nobody knows whether he turned up by accident because he got pushed there by the winds, or whether he actually turned up to kind of, you know, get one over the Portuguese king for turning him down. It's an extraordinary story. This whole period is an extraordinary period of history with these great characters, their feuds between Portugal and Castile, and the explorers who went out to try their luck across the Atlantic.
It's one of the things that really fascinated me about conquerors and the way that you presented this was that it wasn't just about any one of those individuals, as fascinating as those characters are. And I mean, and you really bring them to life in that book. But about the way in which it's the confluence of all of these different things, that you have these incredible characters in the right place at the right time with these supporting systems and this repository of knowledge and all of this technical expertise drawn from all across Europe, whether it's Italian methods of kind of pooling capital to fund these voyages, or you mentioned German cannon founding, Portuguese navigational expertise, that it took all of those things coming together in the right place at the right time to produce this outcome, these incredible voyages of discovery and trade and exploration.
Yes, it is an extraordinary moment, and I think it's really why we think 1492 or whatever as being a turning point. It's the collective development really over a long period, as you say, of all these skills that had taken. There was a great deal of debate during the 15th century about the world, you know, what was it possible to enter the Indian Ocean at all, or was it a closed system, freeing themselves from classical ideas about the shape of the world, its size, the bringing together of mathematical skills, cartographic skills, sailing skills, the technological skills of navigation. The Portuguese actually carried out all their initial voyages in quite a small ship called the Caravel, which was very good for sailing up African rivers, and then moved on to larger ships to manage the voyages, the 12,000-mile round trip. So it brought all these things together into a kind of early modern moment of moving beyond received knowledge from the classical world, which had held people in thrall for, you know, hundreds, thousand years, to looking evidence-based learning, feedback, and application of a whole range of practical and intellectual skills. And it is one of those moments, you know, in history. And rightly, we applaud this moment, or we can say we applaud it, but we recognize the breaking open of the mold of the medieval world could be defined by something like the Columbus voyage, which has become the conventional marker of that process, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so one of the things that was really striking to me in reading Conquerors was the raw brand of violence that the Portuguese brought to the Indian Ocean. You know, I mean, hangings, beheadings, lots of public application of force. So where did that come from, and how did the Indian Ocean react to it?
It came really for the Portuguese out of a crusading background. Hmm. We have to realize that while they were carrying out their adventures in India, at the same time they were as busily involved in crusading in Morocco. They had this very narrow view of the Islamic world, and they carried this kind of this sort of hatred, almost with low advisors, with them into the Indian Ocean. They'd expected to find a Christian sea, rather remarkably, owing to the sort of rumors that there were Christian kings in the Indian Ocean. And they found a world that was in the hands of Islamic traders. This led them really very quickly into confrontation with Islam. And really the marker of this, I think the one event which stands out and which has been deeply remembered by Indian historians particularly, is an event in 1502 when Vasco da Gama alights upon a ship returning with passengers who have been on the Hajj to Mecca, men, women, and children, and they offer to give him all the things they've got on board. And he turns them down, and he decides that he's going to burn them alive in this ship. And this actually horrified certainly some of the Portuguese who watched this. But this went against everything that was understood about the nature of sailing in the Indian Ocean. The sort of maxim of the Indian Ocean was that the sea is open to all. The Portuguese came looking for monopoly. They were bred to think about monopoly trading. The Pope had divided the world up into two bits for them, don't forget. One was the bit that Columbus had explored west of a certain line in the Atlantic Ocean, and east of it was to be Portuguese. So the idea was to dominate all trade. Vasco da Gama was an extreme example of cruelty without any point at all. Other people, one of the great sort of conquistadors of the Indian Ocean, a man called Alfonso de Albuquerque, he used violence in a more exemplary way. But the aim really was, given that there was asymmetrical forces that the Portuguese had, very few men compared to those that they confronted in many of the battles and sieges that they withstood on the coast of India, the idea really was to traumatize their opponents into submission. And this certainly left a long stain, I think, on the memory of the peoples of India. And Indian nationalist historians will really look upon the arrival of Vasco da Gama as the beginning of a period of unbridled ship-borne European imperialism. And the Miri incident, the incident of Vasco da Gama's destruction of this one ship, pitiful story, really symbolized this. And this was certainly echoed around even in the 19th and early 20th centuries. The account of this has been very resonant for the people of the Indian Ocean. People have long memories. The Spanish say, great sins cast long shadows, and I think it certainly did.
It's that incident in particular has always stood out to me, simply because it kind of gives the lie to the idea that you can't judge people in the past by their actions, because contemporaries of da Gama's were not okay with what he had done in that case. I mean, there, if memory serves correctly, some of the other captains of the ships were like left records to say that they thought that that was a bad idea, that they shouldn't have done it. And in some other cases of exemplary violence as well, right, that there were other captains who said, these things are not good. We should not be doing this. This is a great sin. That it wasn't just the way things were or the way things had to be.
No, that's right. And actually, as you said, Portuguese responses to some of this were much more nuanced than thinking that, you know, all Portuguese were bloodthirsty murderers. And you can see a humanist streak, really. It's certainly an account of the clerk of Vasco da Gama's ship during the Miri incident, Tomé Pires, who said, I can't understand why we're doing this. You know, this is awful. So there was more to it than meets the eye. Having said that, though, there was the conquistador mentality, and there's an odd, I think, contrast in the Portuguese mentality, certainly among the noble class. On the one hand, these people were scientific, they were observers of the world, they could draw great maps, they learned languages, they observed, they took in, and they learned. But at the same time, they were still enthralled to ideas of personal medieval glory and the idea of single-handed combat and winning things by feats of arms, which sometimes led them into dreadful catastrophe when they all be killed. So these people are both modern and medieval at the same time, and you can see these two characteristics at work in alternating moments throughout this episode.
It's a really fascinating kind of contrast, because you wouldn't think that those two things would mesh, and yet we see them meshing very comfortably in the minds of these people, that there was no real division for them between the brutal application of violence and the ability to have a kind of a nuanced understanding of winds, of currents, these great technical sailing skills, a really advanced understanding of navigation, what the world looked like, but at the same time, the willingness and ability to do terrible violence.
Yes, it is an extraordinary thing. I mean, actually, the Portuguese undoing is going to be the result of this gung-ho chivalric thing when the Portuguese king and almost all the nobility were wiped out in one day in Morocco in 1578, I think. So, you know, but these two things went hand in hand. And you can see modernizers at work in this. Alfonso de Albuquerque, who's kind of like the Pizarro or the Cortez of the great conquistador of the Indian Ocean, is trying to persuade the Portuguese nobility to organize themselves so that they fought coherently in battles, in regiments with planned techniques. And this was fiercely resisted by these people who said, no, I'll be the first man to the top. And there were cases actually in Morocco where the Portuguese spent so long arguing about who was going to be the first person up the ladder to capture a fort that they were all killed. So there's some very, very strange, you know, mentalities at work here, which are kind of inconceivable to us now, but give us a sense that we're on the cusp of two ages of thinking about the way that you see the world and the way you act within it.
It's one of my very favorite things about this period is the way in which these kind of what seem to us to be exceptionally rational and forward-looking ways of seeing the world and of understanding the world around you, that they coexist with these things that seem so incredibly irrational to us. And you mentioned this kind of these noble ideas of chivalry and honor and personal prowess. And it's always really striking to me that those things seem to crop up more in the 16th century than they do in the 15th century before it, that as you move into this increasingly kind of modern and rationalistic world, the nobility becomes more invested in these ideas of personal glory rather than less.
Yes, that's an interesting one. In a way, they're kind of, maybe they're holding on to the past here. Mm-hmm. Maybe they're uncomfortable with the arrival of unchivalric ideas like muskets, which can shoot a man down, you know, 100 yards rather than going over the top with a sword. And but there is this tension. It's very strong there, I think, between these two sides. Because on the one hand, you've got guys who are observing the pattern of the tides, who are explaining to the world. The Portuguese wrote a lot about that. You know, the people in India haven't got the heads of dogs and don't walk upside down, sitting alongside this other side. And it's hard to account for it, really. But I think, in a way, the modernizing streak, and I think this goes for the Spanish as well, was kind of, in a way, overtaken by this nostalgia for the past. One of the great questions you can ask yourself is, great wealth poured into both Portugal and Spain in the 16th century, and it trickled through their hands, that a lot of the essential skills involved in commercial activity, they simply didn't have, because their mentality was very much landowning, feudalistic ways of looking at the world. Albuquerque realized this, and he said, He wrote back to the king of Portugal and he said, sire, you know, if you want your things handled properly on a commercial basis, it's better to send for a man from Bologna. He may cheat you, but he will cheat you quite effectively. the Portuguese were actually hopeless at the business of business, which is why in the end they're going to be outflanked by the much more savvy Dutch when it comes to dealing with the spice trade. And they developed to a certain point, but they couldn't carry it forward, and they didn't really have a full renaissance of their society. The development of, they didn't develop a merchant class effectively. They outsourced that to people from the Low Countries or from Italy, and they got left behind, sort of locked in. I mean, if you like, Cervantes and Don Quixote is kind of the model of something that relates, I think, to the Iberian Peninsula, of a sort of nostalgia for the courtly world that somehow they couldn't really quite shake off, certainly within the class structure of these societies.
That's really interesting, because it hits on kind of the inherent internationalism of these voyages in general in this period, too, that when it came to assembling the financial expertise to make things go, because these are tremendous investments of money and time and energy, that both the Portuguese and the Castilians effectively outsourced that to Italian experts. They were, whether they were Genoese resident in Genoa or whether they were kind of Genoese immigrants to the Iberian Peninsula or Florentines, that it was always these kind of Italian bankers who were the ones who were assembling the capital necessary to put these voyages together, that was not a skill or a tendency that they used themselves. Well, it's like, why would you when you have Genoese or Florentine experts right there?
Yes, that's right. I think the particular shortfall of the Portuguese situation was that the kings of Portugal were trying to run this as a royal monopoly, rather than allowing the development of private enterprise among the Portuguese themselves. And in fact, quite a lot of the Portuguese went rogue and did their own stuff. But they really never got it together in terms of allowing a merchant class to prosper within their society. The Jews might have done it for the Portuguese, but unfortunately, probably against their better judgment, they had to expel the Jews themselves because a marriage between the King of Portugal and the Castilian princess, so Manuel the First. So they outsourced it, and they saw the money trickle away to people elsewhere. And actually, of course, when they shot themselves doubly in the foot by expelling the Jews from Portugal, because they then went off to Bruges and Antwerp and Amsterdam with all the secrets of the spice business in their luggage. So it drained away, and it drained away in 100 years. You know, in 100 years, the water had gone out of the bottom of the bath, so to speak.
Yeah, so we're going to take a quick break, and then when we come back, we're going to broaden the focus a little bit and talk a little bit more about some of the rest of Roger's works.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, and we're back. So I want to broaden things out a little bit. So most of your books have really focused on the 15th and the 16th centuries. What drew you to this period in the first place? Like, what do you find so interesting about it?
What drew me to this originally was I was very I spent, when I was a young man, quite a lot of time in Istanbul. And I was very interested in the fall of Constantinople. Which is the book that I wrote first. And I realized that the end of the medieval, the beginning of the early modern period, is a fascinating one. For some of the reasons we've already talked about, to do with being on the cusp of new ways of looking at the world, new inventions, invention of gunpowder, very significant, obviously, in the way that people fought wars in the 15th century, sailing ships, and so on. And we see the emergence of new empires, the ability of the Ottoman Empire, the Habsburg Empire, to bring together all the resources in a different way that we saw the Portuguese bring them together, to tax, to efficiently, to aggregate very large armies, to develop the logistics and the infrastructure to bring them into battle. And therefore, we see some titanic contests in the in the 15th and 16th centuries. The Ottoman Empire and the end of the Byzantine Empire, then the Ottoman Empire and the Habsburg, Suleiman the Magnificent and Charles V and Philip II of Spain. Huge clashes in the Mediterranean world. The other thing that particularly interested me was, of course, the invention of printing. And the invention of printing means that suddenly we get a great deal more source material to draw on. For the fall of Constantinople, there are only about 9 sources, and they're quite short. They're quite good, but they're quite short. And we start to see in the 16th century a vast amount of written material being produced, memoirs, records, all kinds of stuff that enriches the stories that can be told. From my point of view, there's enough, but not too much. I can't imagine how anybody writes a history of the Second World War. But suddenly there's a boom, social media of the 16th century. There's a boom in resources. And this makes the source material much, much richer, much deeper, and more rewarding to work with.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I mean, I was initially trained as an early medievalist and kind of somebody who worked on late antiquity. And for my doctoral dissertation, I read literally every Latin language letter written between about 450 and 600. And I could do that for a project. There's just not that much of it. It was it was a couple thousand letters. But when you get into the 16th century, suddenly, you know, there are thousands of just French language sermons from the 16th century, just as one small corner of one genre of text that exists there. You can say so much more about the world. You can say so much more about the various kinds of people that lived in it. You get so much more granular detail about what people's lives were like. That's a really good point.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the thing that I particularly look for is firsthand accounts. Mm-hmm. You know, I like to hear voices from the past. Obviously, one delves into the bean counting stuff as well, and you get more personal memoirs. I think, particularly writing history that involves, say, the Ottomans and the Christians in the 16th century. One of the difficulties is that Christian sources tend to start throwing out a great deal of personal first-hand accounts. I was there, I saw Giovanni shot dead, you know, this kind of stuff, which is fascinating. And unfortunately, the Ottomans don't have this tradition. In fact, they don't have printing, really, till the 18th century. But those first-hand accounts suddenly, I wouldn't say they explode, but they certainly increase considerably. And they greatly enrich our knowledge of what it was like to be there. These people may not be telling the truth, but they are telling you what they want you to hear, and it's very often very fascinating to dig out this stuff.
That's a really excellent point. I mean, I read a really interesting book a couple of years ago that was just about Renaissance military memoirs, that's a whole genre of text that exists in the 16th century that did not exist beforehand, really, to any great degree. So especially if you want to write about military topics, all of a sudden there's an explosion of kind of information that's available to you, and you can really get a sense for, as you mentioned, the mentalities that people brought to it. I mean, in terms of people not telling the truth, my favorite one of those is the memoir by the German knight Grütz von Berlichingen, where he just outright exaggerates or lies constantly throughout the whole text, but you get this really interesting sense for how he saw the world.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes, you can't be certain if people are telling you the truth, but they're telling you about themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's really fascinating.
It is. But as I say, I wouldn't know how to tackle, 20th century history, because unless you've got a vast team of researchers, large projects, I'd be driven crazy. I think it's just the right amount of stuff for me, I think, in those two centuries, really, 15th and 16th century.
Well, it allows you to tell a story that's both big and small at the same time. It allows you to tell a story that's personal while still being able to tell kind of a sweeping narrative, a sweeping story, without having to dig so deeply that that you feel like you're getting stuck in some tiny corner.
Yes, that's right. I think that's absolutely right. You can move between the sort of macro importance of something and then the human scale, really, and they can give us some sense of being there. And I think it's difficult. No matter how hard we try, it's really very difficult to imagine ourselves in these situations. But we can get some sense of the past is a foreign country, as we keep telling ourselves, and yet it gives us some sense that these are people like ourselves as well.
Yeah, that's true. That you can get much more of a sense for the ways in which those people were like us. So switching gears a little bit, thematically, most of your work deals with the sea, and in particular with the Mediterranean. So kind of trade and naval warfare and these interconnected worlds, they all feature really prominently. What brought you to that thematically, leaving aside kind of the period aspect?
Well, this is family history, really. My dad was a naval officer who spent all his professional life at sea, a lot of it in the Second World War. A lot of it in the Mediterranean. In fact, he's got a ship that he was in lies on the seabed off the coast of Crete. And so I spent quite a lot of my childhood around naval bases, making visits to various warships at the time when Britain still had a navy of some size. And when I was about 9, my parents went to live on the island of Malta for 2 years. Oh. And I was, these things strike you at a certain age. It was so evocative being somewhere warmer, with a great deal. Malta's a fascinating place. It was very small, and my mother was very interested in history. Took us around everything from Neolithic sites, of which there are a large number, to the fortifications of the Knights of St. John. So these things, Mediterranean history, always fascinated me, just for reasons of sheer personal experience. And ditto, although I've never actually been a great sailor myself. I get seasick rather easily, I have to say. The business of shipping, both the technology and the way that it has connected the world, and certainly, I suppose, from the European perspective, and certainly from the British perspective, a lot of our history has been bound up with shipping. The creation of an empire has been a seaborne event, and being an island with a large coastline, we've always tended to have this close attachment to the sea. So I was always really interested in those things, not just from the warfare point of view, but the way that it allows people to mingle. Ships are the way in which people the most effective way of moving goods before modern times. It allowed the interconnection of peoples, goods, diseases, and it brings together, you know, a whole range of fascinating topics to do with history in both its social and its narrative forms. So, but it's a naval background, really. I can still smell the sound of I can still smell the oil from British destroyers if I close my eyes when I was a child.
Well, by taking that kind of thematic perspective, it allows you to center this really cool interconnecting theme that you can apply to different places and different times, but that really brings out that one kind of consistent thing, these interconnections and the minglings. It's something that stands out really strongly across all your work, is the meeting of different cultures via the medium of trade and shipping and warfare and the sea.
Yes, I think that's right. I am fascinated. I got particularly fascinated by the Indian Ocean, which seemed to me, you know, the most fantastically rich trading hub. Par excellence, it seems to me, the most extraordinary arena for the exchange of goods, peoples, religions. I suspect it was probably a nicer place before the Portuguese came along. And it's all turning on the turntable of the monsoon, which allowed people to to trade with each other. I used to think of Islam really as a religion of the sword, but when I started to look at the Indian Ocean, I realized that actually it was a religion spread on the decks of Arab dhows by merchants. Mm. And you know, Sinbad the Sailor and all that, and extraordinary intermingling of populations. I'm not deeply knowledgeable about this, but I did look at it when I was studying the Portuguese arrival into this arena. And the Portuguese probably spoiled it. It is said that even in the 1950s, there were Arab dhow captains who still curse the name of the Islamic pilot who helped Vasco da Gama to get to India. But those kinds of connections that could be made are very, very rich. I'm obviously fascinated by warfare as well. And the connections, you know, across time and space that can be made by maritime technologies are wonderfully interesting to think about.
So kind of building on that a little bit, you have a tremendous gift for putting the reader right there, like on the deck of that ship as Vasco da Gama is headed toward India. I mean, it's you're a true master of narrative history and telling a great story. How did you hit on this style? What allowed you to develop this approach?
Well, I have to come clean here and say that my academic background is not history, it's literature. And the structure of narrative is something that I'm kind of interested in. It's part of my kind of sort of vocabulary, as well as I'm interested in actually the way that the words are put down on paper. I suppose I try and write the books that I would want to read, and in that, it's a slightly more hit and miss business arriving at the structure of a book than might appear from the way that the way that they turn out. Sometimes I find, and it certainly happened with the Portuguese book, I thought I was going to write a book that started in about 1414 with the first Portuguese exploration attack in Morocco and end up with what I referred to earlier, the annihilation of the Portuguese in Morocco in 1578, 150 years of crusading history and exploration of the world. And I realized that this was too vast. I've made several false starts with books. So I've written the first 30,000 words and thought, actually, I've needed to write these words to work out that I've started in the wrong place. So I went back and I looked at the conqueror's narrative again and realized that the hub of this was like a 30-year period between, 1480 or 1470, whatever, to about 1520. And it was very tempting to go, and I thought, gosh, there's a fantastic siege of Goa in, 1536. I need to write about that. And I have to say, no. People will just get bored, really, or it'll be one damn thing after another. And so it's really a question of trying to find what is the heart of this, both in terms of narrative, but also in the heart of a historical episode and its meaning. And sometimes, there are blind alleys, and it's a sort of heuristic process of doing it and then finding out that, heck, I've filled, 10 books full of notes. And there's always this temptation to say, I've learned it, so I've got to write it down. And then you have to kind of slap yourself on the wrist and say, no, you've got to put that to one side. This is the bit that you really need to write. I was also told quite early on by the first publisher I worked for to say, don't write a book of more than 300 pages. So I've tended to write shorter books, although if I look at each one, they'd be getting a little bit longer. Although I do read lengthy books, sometimes with pleasure, but sometimes not, I've tended to feel slightly gratified when people say, I wish this book had been longer, in a sort of odd way. You don't want to kind of outdo the patience of your... Of the reader experience. There are some kind of aesthetic and literary strategies, I suppose, at work in the way that I construct this. The important thing that you cannot do is every now and then you think, God, I wish that Vasco da Gama had done that. Couldn't he just have done it? And you have to slap yourself on the wrist and say, no, this is not fiction. If you can't find a genuine source for it, you can't speculate. But there comes a difficult area, I think, when you're writing narrative history, because my aim is to write well-written, well-researched history for general readers. And the problem there is that there are many cases when the evidence is mixed, and really you really need to have a discussion about two or three different interpretations of an event. But this can become very dull for people, and therefore it's a fine balance to walk through between just going for what seems to me maybe to be the best most likely course of events, and explaining that actually it is more complicated than that. So, I sometimes spend quite a lot of time thinking, how much should I explain about, some theological point which is actually significant to the way that the fall of Constantinople turned out, or that we just don't, there are many cases where we just don't know, we just don't know what happened, and there are all sorts of speculation, and therefore you have to kind of look yourself in the eye with these things, and they can be quite difficult to decide on, making that balance between, narrative coherence, if you like, and historical detail.
Yeah, well, like, the end result in your case is stories that really jump off the page at the reader. I mean, like, I've taken a lot of inspiration from the way that you structure things and the way that you bring the story out. It's been a tremendous pleasure to read your books. I look forward to reading whatever the next one's going to be. And kind of on that note, do you have another project planned? Is there something you're working on?
Yes, I'm writing about the end of the Crusades at the moment.
The fall
of Acre in 1291. Which is extremely interesting. The sources are problematic. And I've just been to Acre in northern Israel to have a look at the site, actually. And I'm due to finish that one in the autumn, and it will be out next year.
Oh, my gosh. Well, I cannot wait to read that. That sounds incredibly fascinating. Roger Crowley, thank you so much for your time today. It was an absolute pleasure chatting with you.
Thank you very much, Patrick. I'm honored to have a chance to speak with you and to put some material forward for your readers and listeners.
Thank you. Good. Yeah, thank you again. That was fantastic. It was very illuminating.
Okay. I was having a look at the podcast. They're certainly very, very varied, aren't they? It's a fantastic resource of, you have a lot of followers, I gather.
Yeah, we get an episode like this will probably have somewhere within a couple of months, we'll probably have 80,000 to 90,000 downloads around about that point,
right,
somewhere in there. It's pretty good. A fair few people listen, and a lot of people, I'm currently doing a series right on early modern topics. So I think a lot of people will be interested and hopefully will follow up with your books. I mean, I've certainly enjoyed the heck out of them. They're part of what drew me to this period after I finished the Fall of the Roman Empire stuff.
Interestingly, actually, it hasn't done terribly well in the States,
and really,
and I put this down to the Columbus thing, really, in a sort of odd way. I don't know. I think my publisher lost interest in me, maybe because the guy who commissioned it went to another company. But I was quite interested in that. Actually, the people I was really worried about were the Portuguese, how they were going to take with having their great conquistadors presented as murdering bastards, really.
Yeah, how did they respond to that? I'm curious.
Well, apart from one right-wing website, Portuguese language website, which accused me of political correctness, really very well. I think part of it is the novelty value that nobody writes about. Foreigners don't write about Portuguese history.
Huh.
And it's been reprinted 7 times in Portugal. So I think they're curious about, this is their golden age. And during the period of Salazar, this was an unmitigated tale of glory. And then it became a kind of socialist, the other side flipped up for a certain group of people. But I think they're genuinely curious to see an outsider writing about their history. And it seems to have found it interesting as far as I can make out. So, it's been an interesting one. But I was worried for a while.
Well,
see what would happen.
It was
that
one
I'd
of the
be barred from Portugal.
It was one of the things that was really striking to me as I was doing my research for the episodes that I just wrote on the Portuguese voyages, like how little some aspects of the Portuguese Empire have been covered in English and how deep the Portuguese literature on that stuff goes.
Yeah, absolutely. What's interesting is that in the 19th century, quite a lot of stuff was translated.
Hmm.
And Vasco da Gama was a well-known name. And, 20th century, it's rather died away. But one of the rewards for learning Portuguese and then slogging through a very large number of pages in old Portuguese, it was like chewing concrete doing this stuff, but it was rewarding because I was getting stuff that actually wasn't available in English. Mm-hmm. And that was, you know, that was when you come up with a fantastic story that nobody else has told, or extracts from Albuquerque's letters, which are a kind of really tough read. That's really, really rewarding to do. And there's a massive material that they wrote on all sorts of things that has never made it into English at all. And that's really great, actually, to use stuff that other people haven't used in your own language.
Yeah, seriously. Well, again, thank you so much for your time. It really was a pleasure chatting with you. I hope we can do it again when your new book comes out, because I would love to hear more about that.
Okay, thanks very much, Patrick. Yeah.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.